This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Adaf Suif with Michael Silverblatt, recorded in Santa Fe, April 9, 2003. Adaf Suif, born in Egypt and living in London, brings her knowledge of Arab history, culture, and gender politics into her English language novels and stories. Here she reads from her novel, The Map of Love, and then joins in conversation with Bookworm host Michael Silverblatt.
Hi, my name is Michael Silverblatt, and I'm the producer and host of a radio program that airs around the country, including KUNM, on NPR. It's an honor to be here at the Lansing Performing Arts Center and a pleasure always to take part in the Readings and Conversation series. And it's a particular pleasure to be in front of this audience, which I think feel like I've grown up with by now. I want to bring to your attention two events. One I suspect you'll flock to, it's Louise Gluck on the 21st of May, so I won't tell you about her. But Les Murray is one of the poets that you should be tracking. He's an Australian poet. The things that he can do, having done this immensely long poem, he's been writing tiny lyrics recently, it seems to be to prove that he can do anything. And Dennis O'Driscoll is a remarkable poet and literary critic whose work I've only recently been exposed to, so you're in for a treat. And that's what comes up. As you know, this will proceed from reading to conversation. And I'm here to tell you that I've been waiting for this evening for nearly a year and a half. What happened was that there was to be, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation, an evening of Arabic writing that was to take place at a major American university. Writers were invited from all over the world to attend, as well as writers whose work, by and large, we don't know. Now, I don't know about you, but just think if what you knew and all you knew about America was from the television, or our movies, or our politicians, okay? So what I'm trying to say to you is that we don't know the Arabic culture in any meaningful way until we know the works of the poets, the philosophers, the novelists, the thinkers. Thank you. As always, we're being presented with misrepresentative extremes. Now, like many of you, I'm sure, I'm in a state of mourning, and please, you know, I this is an unbearable world at the moment, and I, you know, what I find myself doing mostly at home, aside from reading right now, is puzzles, old puzzles from the 1920s and 30s, cut out of wood, because I need so badly to be reminded that it was once a world in which we were interested in solutions, that things could be solved, and that a game that a child played had the end when the pieces came together. And if you just spent your time carefully at it, the pieces came together. Maybe there were missing pieces over time, but we now live in a world, I hate to say it, where most games are played to be played again so that you can score higher. There's no solution. You see, you don't come to the end of the game in a peculiar way, and you don't understand the game. It's a computer game, and you don't really know how it works. You know how to play it, but not its workings. And there was once, it seems to me, a world that you could look at and understand, and I am in mourning for the passing of that world. I think that that world is represented by the novel, which is a world interested in how things work. The novel, classically, gives us news. One of the amazing things about Adaf Suif is that her books come to us the way novels once did, from afar, with news about another culture, about something we don't know, about a world in which women are not treated the way women are here, but are thinking and feeling. And we don't remember what it's like to know the inside life of the culture of repression. The giving voice, which of course, you know, even in her own culture, led the early stories not to be published in Arabic. The giving voice, the amazing thing, I have to tell you, I learned that her first novel, In the Eye of the Sun, was translated into Arabic by Adaf Suif's mother, which I think is a very interesting thing, considering that the novel is about, in many ways, a mother and a child. The Map of Love, it seems to me, is one of the great international novels. Edward Said says that this writer is one of the real writers of gender politics. And when he says so with an interesting addition. He says, it's not as if anyone has captured this abundantly. It's not just rare in Arabic writing, it is rare in world writing. And when you see, when you read The Map of Love, and I'm sure you will see certain men who are scarier than some of the men that Thomas Hardy invented in the Tess of the D'Urbervilles. I don't know if you remember them, but they scared my wits out. I didn't want to, no. You know what I mean. Some people understood at a certain point what sexual terrorism can be. Adaf Suif was born in Cairo. She lives now in London. She has been a translator as well of a novel by a great Palestinian poet who wrote a novel called I Saw Ramallah. It has an introduction by Said. What happened to that conference, which would have had 20-some writers, with a list of books that I inherited from the Lannan Foundation, who were sponsoring it? The university that I don't want to name decided that it could not guarantee the safety of any of its participants, suggested that the foundation be in contact with the State Department in order to pursue this event, and it was dropped, you see. So there was a concerted effort to bring to us these voices, these thoughts, from the people who are people as opposed to icons and misrepresentations. We are living scarily in a world of icons. They inhabit our unconscious. As I was packing, without even thinking about it, I usually take two ties. I'm a mess. I spatter, you know, so I bring two ties. The second tie I brought was orange and had a pattern of camels on it. Just think, you know, the unconscious. I try to be a fairly conscious person, but we want to have a simple representation of everything, and art returns us to complexity. That is what it is for. Adaf Suif has published 4 books. 2 of them are readily available in paperback editions in America, and they're both extraordinary. They bring to you the things that novels are meant to, not just politics, but love, not just love, but romance, not just romance, but counter-romance. You know, these are the real thing. You know, this is the bright book of life. There are 2 books of short stories as well that if you are cunning, you can find over the internet from England. I wanted everything. There are only 4 books. You know, usually I pile up great amounts. There wasn't enough. I wanted more, and so will you. I'd like to introduce Adaf Suif.
Michael, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being here tonight. And thank you, Michael, for an amazing introduction. And a really heartfelt and enormous thank you to the Lannan Foundation and to everybody there who made it possible for this event to happen and for me to be here tonight. For me, on a personal level, it's really important being here, particularly at this time. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll study on in a minute. Particularly at this time, with the things that are happening in the world, to remember really what is extraordinary and valuable. And what I love about America. So I'm very glad to be here. Well, as you see, we have quite a lot to get through. So I thought I'd start with a passage from the beginning of The Map of Love, and then sort of move between the two books. I know there's a wonderful gadget down there that's supposed to tell me about time, but it's too far away for me to really see it. So I think I'll just put this here. Okay, 40 minutes. Okay. This The Map of Love is my latest novel. It was published quite a while ago now. It was published in 99. Since then, I've been writing journalism because things in both my personal and public life have not been conducive to writing fiction. But anyway, in this story, it's you have two stories, two narratives. And in some things they echo each other, and in some things they are divergent. So they are both love stories. And in both love stories, both romances take place across cultures. So you have one partner who is British, and the other is Egyptian, and in the other story, there's the one partner is American, and the other is an American Arab. The two stories are separated by 100 years. So, in the old story, which takes place at the turn of the 20th century, you have an English woman, Lady Anna Winterbourne, who is widowed and who goes to Egypt and there meets and falls in love with Sherif al-Baroudi. And in the contemporary story, which was taking place as the novel was being written, so it was sort of happening in 97, 98, there's Isabel Parkman, who is an American, and she falls in love with Omar al-Ghamrawi, who is an Arab-American of Egyptian-Palestinian descent. And the device with which the novel draws the two stories together is to have a central narrator. And the central narrator obviously lives in the now, and she is a friend of Isabel, and she's the sister of Omar al-Ghamrawi, Isabel's lover. And she is a descendant of the couple from the old story and researches their story and tells it during the course of the novel. It sounds horribly complicated, but it really isn't when it's read. This first section here is in the voice of Amal al-Ghamrawi, who is our narrator. And it takes place in Cairo, April 1997. Some people can make themselves cry. I can make myself sick with terror. When I was a child, before I had children of my own, I did it by thinking about death. Now, I think about the stars. I look at the stars and imagine the universe. Then I draw back to our galaxy, then to our planet, spinning away in all that immensity, spinning for dear life. And for a moment, the utter precariousness, the sheer improbability of it all, overwhelms me. What do we have to hold on to? Last night I dreamed I walked once more in the house of my father's childhood. Under my feet, the cool marble of the entrance hall, above my head, its high ceiling of wooden rafters, 1,000 painted flowers gleaming dark with distance. And there was the latticed terrace of the Haramlik, and behind the ornate woodwork, I saw the shadow of a woman. Then the heavy door behind me swung open, and I turned. Outlined against the glaring rectangle of sunshine, I saw, as I had never in life seen, the tall, broad-shouldered figure of my great-uncle, Sherif Besha al-Baroudi. And as I opened my eyes and pulled the starched white sheet up close against my chin, I watched him pause and take off his tarbush and hand it, together with his ebony walking stick, to the Nubian Sufragi, who leaned towards him with words of greeting. He glanced up at the lattice of the terrace and strode towards me, past me, and into the shadows of the small vestibule that I knew led to the stairs up to the women's quarters. I have not been near this house since my youngest son was 9, 10 years ago. He loved the house, and watching him play and explore while the museum guards looked on, I had found myself wondering, what if we had kept it? But this is not my story. This is a story conjured out of a box, a leather trunk that traveled from London to Cairo and back, that lived in the box room of a Manhattan apartment for many years, then found its way back again and came to rest on my living room floor here in Cairo one day in the spring of 1997. It is the story of two women, Isabel Parkman, the American who brought it to me, and Anna Winterborn, her great-grandmother, the Englishwoman to whom it had originally belonged. And if I come into it at all, it is only as my own grandmother did 100 years ago when she told the story of her brother's love. So that's an opening section. Excuse me. I'm sorry, I need to find everything except what I'm looking. Here we are. Okay, in this next bit, this is a sort of double-voiced bit, because here Amal starts to work with Anna's journals, and what happens is that Amal introduces a passage from the journals. You get a bit of the journal, and then you have Amal's commentary on it, so you kind of have two voices, and I can't do voices. I could sort of run from one side of the stage to another to signal who it is who's meant to be talking. But I'll sort of try and indicate. Okay, so it's... and this goes back to the beginning, really, of Anna's story. Anna had married Edward Winterborn, and the marriage had kind of not really taken off, and he had enlisted in Kitchener's expedition to the Sudan. As I'm sure you know, Egypt at that time was a protectorate of Britain, and fairly newly made a protectorate, and the Sudan, which was administratively part of Egypt, therefore then also fell under British rule. And there was a great uprising in the Sudan at the end of the 19th century under a man who was believed to be holy, al-Mahdi, who was a great popular leader. And the British had sent an expedition under General Gordon, and that had been defeated, and Gordon had been killed. And later they sent an expedition under Lord Kitchener as a sort of punitive expedition. And this was the one that Anna's husband volunteered for. And he comes back from it. He comes back from the events of the Sudan and of Omdurman, and he's very sick, and nobody knows what's wrong with him. Okay, Cairo, May 1997. I am obsessed with Emma Winterbourne's Brown Journal. She has become as real to me as Dorothea Brooke. I want to fill in the gaps, to know who the people are of whom she speaks, to paint in the backdrop against which she is living her life here, on the page, in front of me. I go to the British Council Library, to Daruk Kutub, to the second-hand bookstalls, even though they've been moved from Sur al-Azbakiya up to Darrasa, and browsing among them is no longer so pleasant. I even write to my son in London and ask for cuttings from old issues of the Times. Amal lived in England and had been married to an Englishman, and she'd been there for 20 years, and again the marriage had, well, something had happened, we never know in the course of the book, but basically her children were grown up and she had gone back to Egypt 20 years later. So, I write to my son in London and ask for cuttings from old issues of the Times, and I piece a story together. London, October 1898 to March 1899. The light is like nothing Anna has ever seen before. Day after day, it draws her back. Day after day, it scatters itself on the rich carpets, on the stone or marble floors, on the straw matting. It streams through the latticed woodwork, tracing its patterns on mosaic walls and inlaid doors and layered fabrics, illuminating flowers and faces and outstretched or folded hands. Anna looks down at her own hands, folded tight in her lap, her wedding band gleaming dull against the pale skin, her knuckles raised ridges of paler white. She unclenches her hands, stretched out the fingers, and replaces the hands gently, open, on her knees. Journal. He is not himself. I have heard this phrase before, and now it falls to me to use it. Edward, my husband, is not himself. For 7 months, I followed with Sir Charles. Sir Charles is Edward's father. I followed with Sir Charles all news of the events in the Sudan. For 7 months, I prayed for his safety and for his return unharmed. And now he is back, I hardly know him. He has grown thin, and though his face is flushed with the sun of the south, it is as though a pallor lurks beneath. Mr. Winthrop has seen him and says he has caught some infection of the tropics and shall be well again with tranquility and nourishing food and later exercise. Upon his insistence, Mr. Winthrop's, I go out for a walk in the air each day. And I have taken to walking to the South Kensington Museum, which is a most beautiful and calming place, and where I have come upon some paintings by Mr. Frederick Lewis. They are possessed of such luminous beauty that I feel in their presence as though a gentle hand caressed my very soul. And then we're out of the journal. On a low bed, pressed into a pile of silken cushions, a woman lies sleeping. Above her, a vast curtain hangs, through the brilliant billowing green of which the fluid shadows of the lattice shutters can be made out, and beyond them, the light. One wedge of sunshine from the open window above her head picks out the sleeper's face and neck, the cream-colored chemise revealed by the open buttons of her tight bodice. A small amulet shines at her throat. Anna glances at her watch. She has 10 more minutes. Journal. Today I found Sir William Harcourt in the hall, taking his leave of Edward and Sir Charles. Sir Charles, shaking him repeatedly by the hand, said in his usual robust fashion that it was a sad day for England when a man like Sir William resigns from the leadership because of the conversion of the party to jingo imperialism. He spoke harshly of Rosebery and Chamberlain, calling them men of war, and Sir William said it was the spirit of the age, and he was grown too old to fight it. Edward became much agitated and retired to his chamber. He refused to allow me to sit with him or bring him tea. They are outside the journal now. They are all concerned. The servants go about their business with muffled tread. Visitors leave cards to which she replies with polite notes saying that Edward finds himself indisposed, but as soon as he is better. His father is concerned to the point of anger. Yesterday afternoon she had entered the library to find him speaking to the butler. When he heard her at the door, he had come forward and taken her hands. "Oh, Anna, I have just asked Wilson to take all the shot out of the guns, just a precaution, you know. No sense in having all that lead lying around, don't you think?" "Yes, of course, Sir Charles," she had agreed. "There's no need for it." And when Wilson had left the room and closed the door behind him, she had allowed the fear to show in her voice and eyes. "You don't really think, do you?" "No, no, of course not, of course not." He had paced away from her, the erect soldier's figure striding to the end of the library table. "I hope you don't mind, my dear." He gestured at his boots. "I rode over suddenly, you know." Anna shook her head. Halfway back, he stopped and struck his fist against the back of a chair. "By God, you'll pardon me, my dear, but I feel like taking a whip to him. If he had not the stomach for it, what drove him to go? He requested that commission. He would not be denied. He believed he was doing the right thing. And also, she thought, he wanted action, adventure, purpose, a mission. I told him, though, I told him this was not an honest war. This was a war dreamed up by politicians, a war to please that widow so taken with her Cockney empire. Ah, what's the use? He paused, and Anna came to stand beside him. Together, they stared out of the window at the trees darkening in the quiet square. He turned to her. "You should get out, my dear. This is no life for a young woman." "I do get out, Sir Charles. Mr. Winthrop said I must. I go out every day at 3, and I don't come back till 4 o'clock. "But your little face is getting quite peaky, Anna, my dear." He had put his hand to her chin, and under that gentle touch, she had felt the tears rise to her eyes as they are rising now. Journal. For shame, Anna. To be weeping for yourself now, at such a time. All your thoughts should be bent on him, devoted to him. He is in need of rest, and he cannot find it. How different this homecoming has been from that of his father, when as a child of 10, recently bereft of my mother, I lay on a corner of the smoking room carpet, studying the map of Egypt Sir Charles had given me, and listening to him tell of how they beat Arabi and took Tel Kibir. And I heard him talk of heroism and treachery and politics and bonds, and I felt his anger at the job he had been made to do. But Edward will not speak, and I am afraid. I have not dared to voice the thought, but I'm afraid we are in the grip of something evil. My husband is in the grip of something evil, something that will not allow him to shake off his illness and come to himself. Caroline Burke tells me that Sir William Butler, meeting General Kitchener upon his arrival at Dover, said to him, "Well, if you do not bring down a curse on the British Empire for what you have been doing, there is no truth in Christianity." And Kitchener simply stared at him. I asked her what he meant. What had they done beyond taking the Sudan and restoring order? And she said she did not know, but with such dark looks as left me full of foreboding. I long to ask my husband what this means, for my instinct is that there is a key here to what ails him, but I am afraid. Anna stands up and walks slowly round the gallery, coming to a stop in front of an old man, his white beard and turban set off against a wall of golden brick hung with pages of white inscribed paper. Before him on the floor, robed in vivid reds and blues, sit the children he teaches. A sun-striped cat reclines on a green cushion, watching a pair of doves pecking at the spangled mat. In the half-open doorway, the smallest of the children hesitates. In the street, Anna starts to hurry. It is 4 o'clock, and the light is fading fast. I have failed him. I am constantly and repeatedly failing him. If I could but find the key to the locked door of his mind, I could sweep out all the terrors that lurk there, and he would be well again. For I know there are terrors, and they have to do with the mission he has been engaged upon, which culminated earlier this week in the signing of the Sudan Convention, an event which has greatly angered Sir Charles and his friends, so that they have written to the Times. Sir, what would be said in private life if a guardian and trustee who had undertaken to manage the estate of a minor allowed the estate to run to ruin and then took possession of it as being worthless? In 1884, we forced the Egyptian government to abandon the Sudan and leave it derelict, And now, the opportunity having occurred, we are taking possession of the country as belonging to nobody. It is a comment on the tone of the age that we should be doing this with the apparent approval of the whole world, moral and religious. It would also appear, according to the convention signed by Lord Cromer and Boutros Pasha, that we are saddling on Egypt the whole cost and labor of the war of reconquest not yet completed, and making her budget responsible for the Sudan deficits. This invention, the British Empire, will be the ruin of our position as an honest kingdom. Yours, etc., Charles Winterbourne. Sir Charles tells me that George Wyndham said to him plainly that it is agreed by the powers that the aim of African operations is to civilize Africa in the interests of Europe, and that to gain that end, all means are good. I cannot believe George truly meant that all means are good, but he is Under Secretary for War and is bound to espouse more warlike principles than Sir Charles would think right. Dear God, dear sweet Lord Jesus, I pray constantly for my husband's mind and for his soul. He is grown weaker and cannot or will not leave his room. Another entry. Caroline came to visit and told me how they say Kitchener's men desecrated the body of the Mahdi, whom the natives believe to be a holy man, and how Billy Gordon cut off his head that the general might use it for an inkwell. It cannot be true, for if it were, I truly fear for Edward now. Another day. Sir Charles tells me that Billy Gordon confirms the story of the cutting of the head, but is angry that the deed is imputed to him. But he will not say who did it. Edward brings up everything we give him now. His stomach cannot retain so much as a cupful of thin gruel, and I fancy he is attempting to purge himself of all manner of things. I beg him to take heart, for our Lord surely watches over him, as he watches over us all. And God judges the actions of men, but surely, too, he judges them by their hearts and their minds, else how can one act be held distinct from another? And surely that distinction he would make. But Edward turns away. Back to Emma. Meanwhile, in my research, I found out that General Gordon's sister has distanced herself from this expedition all along. She has said that if it is to avenge her brother, then she does not wish him avenged, and she is certain he would most strongly have not wished it himself. She says she knows the Mahdi had not wished Gordon dead, but rather had wanted him alive so that he could exchange him for the freedom of Arabi Basha, the exiled leader of the Egyptian uprising of 1882. She tells anyone who will listen that her brother was among the first to come forward when Mr. Blunt set up the fund to defray the expenses for the defense of Arabi, and that he had said, "Here's the money. I'll wager Arabi pays it back himself in a couple of years." Each day now brings fresh horrors, and Edward sickens so that I cannot bring myself to leave the house, nor do I wish it, but content myself while he sleeps with a turn about the garden. The garden in which all things appear so brown and bare and dead that it would seem impossible that May will come and all will be in leaf again. And yet, today, I spotted the cheery white of the first snowdrops, the usual five, faithful to their usual place at the base of the old plum tree, and I was filled with a kind of melancholy hope. Sweet Mary, Mother of God, I pray for my husband's soul as I pray for the souls of all the men who were joined in that terrible event. The papers are full of it. An army of 7,000 British and 20,000 Egyptian soldiers loses 48 men and kills 1,100 of the dervishes and wounds 1,600 in the space of 6 hours. Winston Churchill promises to publish a book that tells how General Kitchener ordered all the wounded killed, and how he, Churchill, had seen the 21st Lancers spearing the wounded where they lay, and leaning with their whole weight on their lances to pierce through the clothes of the dying men, and how Kitchener let the British and Egyptian soldiers loose upon the town for 3 days of rape and pillage. Lady Caroline's cousin tells Sir Charles that a heavy butcher's bill was ordered for that day, and communications with London were cut on a pretext so that no tempering word might find its way to the general. Oh, I do so completely fear for my husband now. For if it is true, and if he took part in those terrible deeds, he who puts honor above all else, and truly thought that in embarking on this expedition, he embarked on a brave and honorable task, I cannot see how he can put it behind him, most particularly when he is so ill in body and at the mercy of the fever which burns him up for hours and leaves him, when it does, limp and so weakened that he can barely take the water that we put to his lips. Edward Winterbourne died on the 20th of March, 1899. He had stood on the plain of Omdurmen, and the thought that had hovered around him in Atbara, in Sawakin, in the officers' mess, the thought that he had for weeks held at bay, rose out of the dust of the battlefield and hurled itself full in his face in its blinding light. And once that thought had revealed itself and taken hold, the fanatical dervishes transformed themselves in front of his eyes into men. Men with their sorry encampments, with their ragtag followers of women and children and goats, with their months of hunger upon their bodies, and their foolish spears and rifles in their hands, and their tattered banners fluttering above their heads. Men impassioned by an idea of freedom and justice in their own land. But still, they planted their standard, and still they rushed forward with their spears, and it was too late to do anything but stand and fire. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Let's move to the present and a slightly lighter note. Actually, my books do have funny stuff and sexy stuff. It's just the times, you know. This is towards the middle of the book, and Amal owns some land which has sort of come down to her from her family. It's in Upper Egypt. And of course, in Upper Egypt, there have been terrorist attacks, and so the government has deployed the army there and so on. And they closed down the school. They closed down the school in the village, which is on Amal's land. And she decides to go and visit her village, Tawasi. And Isabel wants to come with her. So she takes Isabel with her, and they go to visit Amal's village in Upper Egypt. And this is towards the beginning of that visit. The sun had set simply and without display, a plain red disk descending through a clear, darkening sky into a silver horizon. As the light faded, the women had started to arrive, small black tents moving silently up the path. At the door, they took off their shoes. In the hall, the black wrappings came off, and the room was filled with the bright colors of their satin dresses, pinks and purples and greens, resplendent against the dark furniture and plain white upholstery. Each had brought something with her, a dish she had made, a batch of fresh-baked pastry, some eggs, a watermelon, Christmassy when it was broken open in its red and green. Some had small children with them, who wandered round the room, then out of the open door to the larger world outside. Amal had been hugged and kissed again and again. "And this is my brother's fiancée," she had said again and again. And then the welcomes, the blessings, the compliments. "The name of God guard and protect her. He's known how to choose. She's brought light to our village. And she speaks Arabic." "Shwaya," Isabel offered. "Khalas, stay with us here and we'll teach you." "Teach her? You'll teach her our talk? The talk of the fallahin? What else? Shall we teach her the talk of the television? And what's wrong with the talk of the fallahin? When she goes to Cairo, they laugh at her. She can teach us English. What do you say? Will you teach us English, Ya Sitti Isa? And what will you do with English, Ya Habibti?" "We learn. Put a few words together. It might come in useful." "Yakhti, learn Arabic first. Untangle the writing." "Neither English nor Arabic. They've closed it down." Isabel pieced it together. The words she understood, the women's gestures, Amal's occasional murmured translations. The tea tray went round, and the little morsels of kunefa and dalah al-shem they had brought with them from Cairo, and glasses of cold water. "They've closed it down, Yasit, and we depended on it. Where will the children study?" "And the unit. It was useful for us." the one of us had just about convinced her husband about this thing of family planning, and now they've closed the unit. No loops, no condoms. Yachty, have some shame, you and her. Are your tongues loose or what? Have we said anything? We're women together. Or is the Sitta a stranger? No stranger, but the devil. We're all kin. What will you do, ya Sitta Amal? I don't know. So who would know? Isn't it yours through your father and your grandfather before him? Yes, but talk to the government. And is talking to the government easy? No, but they should have some understanding. The village has done nothing. They've put soldiers at the doors and no one can come near. They say the teachers were terrorists. There are no terrorists in our village. And the midwife, is she a terrorist too? Here she is in front of you. Ask her. Abu Maati's widowed daughter, a plump woman with a smooth face and a blue tattoo on her chin, smiled. What can we do? The government has a strong hand. Strong on the weak. They don't want problems. We didn't make problems. Each one of us minds their own business. While we were coming on the road, Amal said slowly, we saw three young men being arrested. No one's bigger than the government. They do what they like. Lock up the people, burn down the sugar cane. They say the terrorists hide in it and they burn it down. The people are weary, I said to Amal, weary. I'll go see the school tomorrow, Amal said. God give you light. But the soldiers hold nothing in their hands. Not even the head of police can do anything. It all depends on the government in Cairo. May God smooth the path. And since Sitta Isa is here with us, tell her, ya Sitta Amal, tell her to tell her government to lighten its hand on us a little. Everything that happens, they say, America wants this. They cancel the peasant cooperatives, America wants this. And when you go to the bank for the loan to put in your next crop, they tell you you have to pay so much interest. What are they saying? Isabel had asked, and Amal had translated. The women wanted her to translate. They cancel the subsidies on sugar and oil, America wants this. The price of medicine has become like fire. It's not America. Amal was part embarrassed, part amused. It's the World Bank, and it's the same thing. Isn't America the biggest country now, and what she says goes? Yes, but the matter, what? It's more complicated than that. Complicated or not complicated, we're here on the land, and the one of us works all day till our backs snap, and we still can't live. And the young people, they go and get educated. And then what? They want to get married. They want a house to shelter them. They want to work and live like humans. And life has become very difficult. Isabel had sat and listened, trying to make it all out. Outside in the garden, the children were playing at weddings. A little boy and girl sat on the stairs, green branches and palm fronds arranged around them to suggest the kusha, the wedding bower. The little girl had a white cloth on her head, and looked down at the ground shyly as the boy reached out to hold her hand. Two girls with scarves drawn tight around what would later become their hips were dancing in front of them. The rest of the children sat in a circle at their feet. One drummed on a sheet of wood, and the others clapped and sang. My father said, oh, pretty dark one, Allah Allah, don't ride no more on your donkey, Allah Allah. I'll up and buy you an aeroplane, and I want some Pepsi Cola, for I won't drink tea. Go get me Pepsi Cola, for I won't drink tea. Get up, girl, you and her, get up, you who should be beaten. Look at the kids in a hurry for themselves, kids who can be frightened but not shamed. My father said, no, don't go out, Allah Allah. You might get black and never be white, Allah Allah. Just keep your whiteness for your groom. And I want some Pepsi Cola, no I won't drink tea. Go get me Pepsi Cola, for I won't drink tea. Thank you for putting up with this. Right. Right. These will be two very short bits to end with. This is Cairo, the 20th of October, 1911. And as you see, it's towards the end of the novel. And the group of friends that by then the reader will have become familiar with are talking about what's happening in the area. One is the Minister of Education, Ya'ub Artin Desha. This is Egypt, of course. Shukri Bil Athali is a notable from Nazareth in Palestine. Ismail Sabri is a poet. And our very own Sharif al-Baroudi is there with them. And they're talking basically about the possibility of a world war. This is 1911, and the signs are of 1914 coming up. The Entente Cordiale, of course, has been signed between Britain and France, allowing Britain a free hand in Egypt and France a free hand in Lebanon, Algeria, etc. So there's a conversation, and then we go into Sharif Desha, our hero's mind. And the question is that between the nations of Europe, is there going to be a war or is there going to be an alliance? A war is bad and an alliance is worse. And one of them has to happen. This is a race to subjugate the world. Each nation using the tools it masters best. France, brute strength. Italy, terror. Britain, perfidy. False promises and double dealing, the Zionists' business schemes, blackmail, stealth, and Egypt. What is Egypt's strength? Her resilience, her ability to absorb people and events into the pores of her being. Is that true, or is it just a consolation, a shifting of responsibility? And if it is true, how much can she absorb and still remain Egypt? Sharif Desha looks up at Noor's trees. Noor is his daughter, who is 5, and he planted these trees for her when she was born. Sharif Desha looks up at Noor's trees, taller than him now, and sturdy after 5 short years, his daughter and the light of his eyes. When she hugs him, she pats his back as though he were in need of comfort. How he wishes he could protect her. Turn her loose into life as he releases her into this garden, free but lovingly watched over. And what of Ahmed and Mahrous, nephews? Already they are climbing out on the roof of their school to shout Dusturi Afandina at the windows of Abdin Palace. The constitution is what they're shouting. Will they too spend their lives in battle, caught up in events not of their making, using all their energy, all their intelligence to ensure that things do not happen? But my love, he hears Anna say, you misrepresent yourself again. Look at all that has been achieved. The university is there. Education for women is moving fast. The School of Fine Art already has one brilliant graduate. Rodin himself has agreed to take Mukhtar into his studio. Look at the articles you've written, the people you've defended. Look at your people in Tawasi. Could we have lived our lives? This is another voice. It's the voice of Sharif's sister. And it's written shortly after the events of the first story have ended. Could we have lived our lives ignoring politics? The occupation determined the crops that the fallah planted. It stood in the face of every industrial project. It prevented us from establishing our own financial institutions. It hampered our wishes for education. It censored what could be published. It deprived us of a voice in the Ottoman parliament. It dictated what jobs our men could hold, and it held back the emancipation of our women. It put each one of us in the position of a minor, and forbade us to grow up. And with every year that passed, we saw our place in the train of modern nations receding, the distance we would have to make up growing ever longer and more difficult. It sowed distrust amid our people and pushed the best among them either to fanatical actions or to despair. And in Palestine, we saw a clear warning of what the colonialist project could finally do. It could take the land itself from under its inhabitants. Could we have ignored all this? And what space would have been left for our lives to occupy? And what man with any dignity would have consented to confine himself to that space and not tried to push at its boundaries? And what woman would not have seen it as her duty to help him? My brother had pushed at boundaries for 30 years with every legal means available to him. He campaigned against repressive laws and defended Egyptians against them. With Anna at his side, he met foreign visitors and hoped to influence them. His voice after the death of Mustafa Kemal was the only voice from our part of the world to address the powerful West. But in that year, the first year of the second decade of this century, I sensed a growing distance between him and his work, a distance of the emotions. I should like to end on a note of hope. And it's again from the early story. It starts with Emma's voice narrating, and then it goes for one paragraph into Anna's journal. 17 December 1901. Sharif Basha straightens the covers over his father. He gently moves the old man's foot in from the edge of the bed and covers it with the blanket. Then he leaves the room. It was here, outside the shrine, that he had first come upon his father and Anna at their lessons. The fair head and the turbaned one bent over the book, his father's finger trembling slightly, pointing to something on the page. Anna looking up, her violet eyes smiling into the old man's face. Anna. He walks back to the house. Her contentment delights him, if she is content. He watches out for signs of restlessness. It would not surprise him. God knows he would be restless in her position. He keeps her supplied with paints and paper, with every sheet of music he can find. When she exclaimed over a tapestry, he had a loom sent round and a woman to teach her how to use it. She set up the loom in the courtyard by his father's door, and there she would sit, working slowly as she learned this new art, while the old man watched the balls of brilliant silk twitch and roll in the sunshine. God has compensated you well for your patience, his mother said, and his heart was warm as he watched this strange wife of his busy herself around the old house, as though this was where she had always wanted to spend her days. And his heart was full when she came to him in his bed, as though this was how she had always wanted to spend her nights. I told Hasna to go to bed. You have no need of her tonight. He fumbles as he unclasps, unhooks, unties. He loses patience before it is all done, and crushing the silk, the lace, the yielding body beneath him, he groans into her neck. Oh, Anna, Anna, you have no idea how much I love you. The 1st of January, 1902. Anna's journal. Hub is love. Ashq is love that entwines two people together. Sharaf is love that nests in the chambers of the heart. Hayam is love that wanders the earth. Tih is love in which you lose yourself. Walah is love that carries sorrow within it. Sababa is love that exudes from your pores. Hawa is love that shares its name with air and with falling. Gharam is love that is willing to pay the price. I have learned so much this past year. I could not list all the things that I have learned. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
Just so you'll know, I noticed that this, which I have in hardcover, has recently come out in paperback. It's a translation of I Saw Ramallah by Mourid Barghouti. It's translated by Adaf Souif. Her novels, The Map of Love, which you've heard from, and, oh, this is another copy of The Map of Love.
The Map of Love again.
Well, you see, if there aren't enough books, I have to have something to carry. oh, yes, my prize, a hardcover of In the Eye of the Sun. She contributed to the Granta issue of What We Think of America. Her first book of stories, Aisha, is that how you say it?
Yes.
Aisha. And there's another book as well, Sandpiper and Other Stories, Stolen from Me. Oh, here's that tie I told you. I wasn't lying, you know, I make nothing up.
Maybe I should wear it.
Now, you have been called very respectfully England's George Eliot. Now, we are pretty sure that George Eliot was not called... Excuse me, you were called Egypt's George Eliot. We're pretty sure that George Eliot was not called England's Scheherazade. Could we talk a little bit about dominant cultures and the way they infiltrate? And does it mean anything in Egypt to be called Egypt's George Eliot?
Well, it means a lot to my mother. to people who are into world literature, it's a very high compliment indeed. Yes, that's about as far as it goes. But dominant cultures. I mean, actually, there's a sort of little passage in the Eye of the Sun, which I sort of didn't get to, which sort of explores that idea. And in it, the heroine, Essia, is standing on the embankment in London and looking at the buildings of Whitehall and the view across the river and so on. And this is in 70... It's set in 76. And she is sort of wondering why she feels that she is part of that, why she feels that she's part of that landscape, and wondering whether this is a colonialism that is so insidious that it sort of is part of her very fabric and cannot be gotten rid of. So I guess sort of that the answer to your comment lies sort of somewhere there.
Now, you chose from the very beginning to write in English rather than Arabic, although you could not have.
No, you see, the thing is, and that was really quite odd. It was I can't remember ever when I decided I would write. It's as if I'd always sort of thought that this is something I would do. But what I do remember is when I actually sat down literally one day thought, okay, now you either sit down and try to write or you just stop thinking about it. And there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't sit down and try now, because it's 5 o'clock and you've got nothing to do with the rest of the day. So I sat down and I assumed that I would write in Arabic. And I didn't. I mean, there was just nothing. All the sentences were, all the narrative sentences were happening in my head in English. And the dialogue was happening in Arabic. And I tried, but I could automatically put the Arabic dialogue into English, but I could not do the narrative in Arabic. And eventually I had to decide that either I was going to write in English or I wasn't going to write at all. And so I decided to write in English. I can translate back into Arabic. I can write articles and criticism and letters and reports in Arabic, but I can't write fiction in Arabic. And I think, obviously I've been sort of now asked many times why that is so. Do you want to ask me why that is so?
Only if you won't give the answer you've given before.
Well, the thing is, of course, that I always sense a wish on the part of my interlocutor to find a sort of really sort of deep and important reason. And I think that there isn't. I mean, I think that it is simply that the language I first read in was English. By a fluke, we were in England for 3 years, from when I was 4 till I was 7, and that was when I learned to read. And therefore, I read in English first. And when we went back to Egypt when I was 7 and a half, I relearned Arabic, and I went to an Arabic school and everything. But because in Arabic there is a difference between the written language and the spoken language, it was much easier for me to carry on reading English. And also there are much better children's books in English than there are in Arabic. Once you get to grown-up stuff, it's fine. But for children's books, Arabic was really quite poor. And so I just carried on reading in English. And then I was at home. My mother was professor of English. And so I had her library there. My father was professor of psychology, so his library was really jolly boring. And so I just read my mother's library. And eventually I went to university and studied English literature. So I think that what happened in the course of all this was that English became my literary language, whereas I was perfectly happy living in Arabic. I could only really work in literary terms in English. And that's the short answer is I didn't choose. It just happened.
And yet in The Map of Love, which as you've heard, is something of a tapestry of voices, the voice of a journal versus the more public voice of letters. There are things that need to be translated by the conductor's sister, the friend of Isabel, into English from Arabic. There is the sense that the story cannot be told until it can be assembled and the voices brought together.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. And also, one of the things that it was quite interesting what happened in that book in linguistic terms is that one of the themes running through the book is Arabic. Is the question of expressing an Egyptian or an Arab consciousness in English. There's a passage about the concept, I don't know if anybody here speaks Arabic, but there's a passage about the concept of tarab. And tarab is what happens in the heart, in the soul, in the spirit, when one listens to really, really good Arabic music, and it's not ecstasy is too sort of high flown. I mean I think funk is probably sort of, you know, closest. It's funky, but so there's a whole. I mean, constantly the novel sort of pauses and examines questions to do with the Arabic language, with how it works, and with how it translates and so on. And that's been quite fun. I mean, I think that I wouldn't have had that if I'd been working in Arabic, you know. I wouldn't have been forced to look at Arabic from the outside in this way, and that's, I really like that.
But as the reader goes through, you see, one of the exciting things is it's established early on that Arabic is a language in which roots of words recur, not just in a verb's conjugation, but as nouns, as male and female versions. And so as you're reading, this fascinated me, you learn not Arabic, but how Arabic works. And that, to me, is one of the things that a novelist who has a degree in linguistics can bring to the world, because we don't know, really, a culture until we know something of how its language works.
Yeah.
Could you say something about the working of Arabic as a literary language?
I can just give an example, I suppose, or a couple of examples. There's always a root. There's a root which consists of generally of three consonants, and then there are various derivations, various grammatical forms that come out of this root, and they can sort of float very far away from the original meaning, but there's always a sort of link, and so it's sort of quite interesting detective work to sort of think about the link. So take, for example, the root hadana, H-D-N, hadana, which means to hold close, as in to embrace. Now, hadana, hudn is the noun for this embrace. So you can say to a child, come and sit in my hudn. Okay? That's quite simple. And then you get, for example, hadana. Hadana is a nursery school. Okay? And then haddana, with a stress, haddana is an incubator. Okay? And then ihtadana. Hadana is to hold, to embrace, but ihtadana is to take somebody as a protege. So it's sort of an embrace, but it's one step removed. And so on. I mean, I sort of could... And so what this... there's a one example that came to me that I use in the book, for example, is is mother. Is mother. It's also the very sort of center of things. So, for example, ar-ra's, the of your head, is the very top of it, like that. Ummah is a nation. Imam is a leader of people. Amama is to nationalize, to take something back to the center. There are various others, but they sort of vanished.
One of the things that you point out is that the language does not do this with the word for father.
No, it's quite interesting that father just stands alone. Whether that's because it's just sort of so important and above it all, that or whether it's just, I don't know, it's a singular thing, really. I mean, you get the obvious adjectives and so on, and adverbs, you know, fatherly, father-like, and so on, but it doesn't do this thing of taking off and sort of going into different concepts. But one interesting thing that this means in terms of the language as a literary language is the way in which connotations work. Because if you imagine that each one of these roots, there's the root, and then it's like you have a flight of kites coming out of it at different distances. You can have 7, 8, 10, 12, whatever, and some are far away and some are near. But every time one of these forms, one of these kites is used, somewhere in the back of your reader's or listener's mind, all the other ones are there as well. And so each one comes with that whole sort of cluster, and that's what the artist has to work with and has to be aware of, because obviously, you know, that's what you play with. That's carries a huge emotive force.
In fact, we heard from Bob Balaban about Vietnamese poetry, that level of inflection in Vietnamese make it an ideal language for punning. And so that one of the devotional poets and a beautiful landscape poet is simultaneously, covertly, a great pornographic poet. And this is an example of how the
very nature
of a language inflects what is possible within that language.
That's fascinating.
Now, in the first book, Aisha, there's something very interesting going on, because between these two books, Adaf was telling me this afternoon that she wrote this book of stories, which is a sort of exploded novel in a way. They revolve around the growth of a particular character. But between Aisha and Map of Love, there is a coming of knowledge. In other words, what happened when it was published was that the reviews were incredibly favorable, but it was as if this writer were a pet, in a way. She was telling stories about the harem and what occurred inside, and wedding nights and unusual customs. I truly recommend, though, it's a fabulous book, but it's a book that doesn't end up, given the world today, standing for itself, because this is the writer to the British as exotic. You see? And so, of course, John Fowles, for instance, praises it highly because, you know, for him, like a favorite novel of his, The Wanderer, it establishes the innocence of a culture. Now, what do we mean when we say the innocence of a culture.
It's primitivity.
Yes, right. So this is a way of being supercilious, yes? That great British word. And I wanted to ask you, by the way, I do, nativity is a story narrated by a presence, a spirit, awaiting the day that the woman who has been too educated to believe in presences and spirits will come and listen to it. It's quite a great story. So we're not talking about the quality of stories here. We're talking about what they mean culturally. And again, what will it take to publish in English a novel about life in Egypt that will span 100 years, right? We are going to have to understand the world politically, understand the world sexually, understand the world philosophically, and these folkloric elements very much take a back seat. They become the early book.
Mm. Yeah, well, as I was saying, this was the first thing that I wrote, and as I was describing, I had thought that I would write in Arabic, and I didn't, and I wrote in English, and I wasn't aware of the politics of writing, as it were. And so I wrote those stories as though they would be, well, I didn't even think of the audience, I suppose. And the reviews, as Michael said, they were wonderful. They were very encouraging and very embracing, and so on. It was quite interesting to see how many reviewers referred to Shahrazad, and referred to sort of spinning, shimmering sort of tales of magic, and so that sort of language, of Orientalist type language. I had to sort of think about this. I was doing a talk at the American University in Cairo 2 years ago, and I had to speak about my progress as a writer. And I looked at things, and I thought, well, I definitely become a lot more politicized in the sense of being aware, I suppose, of how my work would be used, I think is what I'm saying. It's quite a sort of difficult idea. It's very difficult because I was brought up believing in art for art's sake, and in sort of a poem is what it is, and now because of sitting in that area between the East and the West, because of sort of, you know, being in that middle ground, and belonging both here and there, well, let me put it this way. When In the Eye of the Sun was published, which is this novel, this one, which was just after that Aisha that Michael has been talking about, there are some passages in it that are very sort of frank sexually, that describe sexual happenings in the life of the heroine. And the book came out, and it was about the time that the sort of extremists were starting to take hold in Egypt. And somebody decided to write a letter to a newspaper denouncing the book. Now, obviously, the book, actually, Michael, this book has not been translated. It was The Map of Love that was translated. So the book was in English, and it was in bookshops. And somebody decided to write an anonymous letter to a newspaper denouncing it and saying that it was part of a Zionist conspiracy to defame Arab women. And that she said she'd sort of lost her sleep after she'd been forced to read 10 pages of it and was traumatized and so on and so on. So, okay, fine. And the paper sort of ran with this story the following week and went and asked sort of 10 people If somebody sort of does this, and if somebody defames Arab womanhood, you know, what in English, what do you say about that? And they had various responses. There were people who said, look, this isn't how you deal with novels. And people who said, well, I haven't read it, so I wouldn't know. And people who said, well, you know, she's obviously a criminal. I mean, it was just a whole variety of... But because this was kind of the whole beginning of that wave of extremism, which part of it was the killing of Farag Foda, who was an Egyptian Islamist thinker, and but who was a liberal Egyptian Islamist thinker, and he was killed at that time. Shortly afterwards, Naguib Mahfouz was stabbed, and so on. But what happened was that after the second piece came out, a whole lot of Arab writers and critics wrote about the book. I mean, they read it and they wrote about it, and these very sort of considered critical articles appeared in papers really all over the Arab world, which were dealing with the book seriously and which were saying that this is one of the most important books to come out of the Arab world for the last 40 years, and this is a book that we should actually appropriate rather than attack, and so on. And it was brilliant. So that kind of stopped the sort of attack that was building up. And the other thing that stopped it, I must say, was that you probably are not familiar, but there was another cause célèbre where they went for a professor in the Arabic department, and he was accused of apostasy, and he eventually had to leave the country, and so on. And this was happening simultaneously, and he was an easier target because his work was in Arabic and he was living in Egypt, and so on, and it just happened much faster on that. So I was forgotten about, which was brilliant. Now, what happened was that the book was available in bookshops, it was very widely read, I was invited to speak at the university, at the American University, at the Cairo Book Fair, and so on, and the whole thing passed. But my publishers in England heard of that, and actually in the States as well. And every time I went to do a reading or an interview or anything, I would find sort of banned in Egypt. I'd sort of arrive at the place and there would be a great big poster saying banned in Egypt, you know. And I would spend time sort of explaining how I wasn't banned in Egypt and how it was sort of, you know, a storm in a teacup and all the rest of it. And then when the book was being reissued, they said, shall we get an endorsement from Salman? And I said, no, thank you very much. You know, that's fine. Let it just go on its own merits. Let's not do this, and so on. And a reviewer, when it was reviewed, when the paperback came out, if you're lucky, you get little notices for the paperback. And a reviewer who was a friend and thought he was obviously doing me a good turn started off his review with hated and reviled in her own country, Suez has nevertheless. I think, well, you know, hold on a minute. It's there is this tremendous desire to see the world in these embattled sort of... confrontational terms. It's sort of much more fun. They thought it would sell more books. In fact, I think that was wrong. And there is also a kind of... Michael used the word supercilious. There's also a kind of patronizing attitude which says, we think this is a good book. We think you're a good thing. Therefore, those people over there must necessarily think you're a bad thing. And that is just so deeply offensive. And also it's very dangerous because I am, well, A, I'm really not interested. B, I very, very much want and need to carry on living my life in two parallel tracks in London and in Egypt. So it does me no service at all to sort of, you know, build me up as some kind of hate figure in Egypt, and it hurts my feelings anyway. And I think that the more interesting thing, I think it's terribly easy and has been terribly easy for the last 15 years or so to get onto the bandwagon of writing about how miserable Arab women are, about sort of Islam as a ghastly, repressive system of thought, about the backwardness, about all that, and ultimately to write things which are really not true and which tickle the Western fancy. And I think what is much more interesting and much more worthwhile is to write stories which people on both sides will recognize as authentic and will enjoy and will get something out of. So if my American or French or Polish reader likes my book, and if my Arab reader says that book rings true, that's what I want. And that's what's much more interesting to me. So to come back very briefly to where I started, which I'd forgotten about actually, is that I suspect now that the stories in Aisha can be used in that kind of denigrating, superior kind of way, because they explore a side of life, a side of society that is what is represented. It's like when you watch the Iraq War or the occupied West Bank on televisions in the West, it's always sort of the poorest of the people and the ones who are dressed in the way that is most foreign to the West and the ones whose sort of facial expressions and mannerisms and great gestures and so on are the most, again, foreign and different that are put forward. It's very, very rarely the sort of middle-class family practicing the piano. And so that's really, I think, what I mean about the politics of literature and of choosing what you write about.
I think it's important that we know here that this is not this is not something we're not guilty of. I'll give you an example that I use because it's a writer that I admire writing about another writer I admire, and I am sure that this would not be said today, but listen. Joan Didion, writing about Garcia Marquez around 15 years ago in the New York Review of Books, said that this magic realism is so popular there because the people are so childlike. Okay. Now, let's remember who Joan Didion is. This is not someone, who is given to simplifications. In fact, is against simplification. Mm. But it is part of the texture of thought to want to create polarizations. This has been, more than anything, what the work of Edward Said has been about. Not advocacy of a thing, but the understanding that the particular is what must be understood and outbalances the general iconic kinds of thinking. I wanted to, in my final question, because this famous light here is beginning to flash, but this is an important question to me. I want to read, because it should be read, a quote from Edward Said on The Eye of the Sun, the novel you did not hear. But this is what we're talking about, the specificity of locating a particular thing, not a general thing. And why these works, it seems to me, are effective as social, political novels is that they are not making singular or clear cases. They are presenting the spectrum of possibility within a sphere of thought. Very interestingly, many reviewers writing about The Map of Love leave out its Egyptian narrator because it's so easy for them to write about the American journalist and the British woman, and yet much of what happens in this novel happens in the mind and heart of the Egyptian woman who is fascinated with the items in the trunk. Remember, we drop what we can't hear. The unconscious is a terrifying thing. Is The Eye of the Sun an Arabic novel in English? Yes. And not just because the heroine, her family, friends, and background are Arab. Throughout its subtly illuminated portrait of Asya, Asya? Suif accomplishes the feat of refining a style that is totally amphibious, that is, not felt as the dutiful translation of an Arabic original, but unmistakably authentic, stubborn, idiomatic, and yes, Arab. By turns ornate, telegraphic, elusive, almost comically fluent, barbarous, painful, lyrical, awkward, and swift, this English is reducible only to Asya, who is decidedly not a symbol or allegory of the Arab woman, but a fully realized, if impossibly situated, Egyptian sensibility in, but not totally of, the West. Pretty good, huh? I want to say that part of the act of thought is making finer and finer distinctions and not lopping together what does not belong locked together. And this is, of course, part of the art of writing as well. But it seems to me to be a tremendously difficult act of acrobatics to be capable right now of depolarizing thought. How does a writer remain mindful of the tendencies to simplify?
Yeah. I think that it probably happens through character. I mean, I think that what you essentially want when you're writing from a novel is you want to capture the interest, you want to capture the heart of your reader. And for your reader to agree, to enter into the world of the novel, they have to care about the characters, they have to care what happens to them, they have to feel them, to believe them. And I don't think that you can create believable characters if you simplify, or if you try, if you've got a sort of type or in mind. I find it very hard to sort of talk about the meta novel, about how one does what one does. But I guess that.
Nor can one answer a question about specifics and generalities. I'm sorry, it's the wrong question. Yeah.
No, but it's an interesting question, and I think it just happens. I mean, once you've got a concept, the concept, of course, the idea of the novel, is born out of what it is that impassions you most at the moment. So, for The Map of Love, what was the moving force behind it was to explore two things. One was the possibility of cross-cultural love and romance, and the other was the relationship between Egypt and the West, and the relationship between where we are now politically and where we were 100 years ago. So that's born of my concerns. But once the novel starts taking shape and the characters start taking shape, then it just takes on its own authenticity, and you forget what your own concerns were and just go with what the characters, I suppose, what is true to the characters. Well, I hope I'm better at writing it than at talking about it, I must say.
Adaf Suif will be signing copies of the novel in the library. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.